KXRN LP Laguna Niguel, Laguna Beach. Member supported KX93.5.
Good morning, Laguna Beach. It's a brisk 48 degrees. You realize this morning we were 16 degrees above freezing? We're just not used to this. Anyway, welcome to Rainbow Radio. Craig, I got a great guest here, Oliver. We're going to get all the dirt about Oliver up in L.A. He's going to call in about 9:15. So here we go. Good morning, Laguna Beach. This is Craig. I want to thank our sponsor this morning. It is Mike Johnson with Compass Realty. Thank you for being with us again. Yet another show. We're still here, and it is getting awfully close to Christmas. Just a few shopping days left. I'm going to have Andora on, as she was last year, and she's going to give us some last-minute shopping ideas, things to keep the Christmas spirit intact and keep us all happy. So yes, Rainbow Radio this morning. Our guest this morning is Oliver, and his name is Mayor, like Mayor Goldwyn, Goldwyn Mayer, whatever it is. Yeah, Goldwyn Mayer. Sorry, great. Sorry, folks. He's serving the LA theater community for over three decades. He's the son of an Eastern European Jewish father and a Mexican American mother. Boy, that's quite a mix. Mayer continuously excels at delivering socially engaged artistic creations that ultimately represent a rich historical record of the multicultural landscape of our society and the very socio-politico-economic issues affecting it. Wow, that's a lot to do, Mr. Oliver Mayer. Mayer is ready to bring to the theater stage his New York Members Only. Actually, it was up in L.A., and I'm not sure where it is now, but we can find out from him. It's a long-awaited sequel to The Members Only and his groundbreaking Blade to the Heat. Mayer's controversial play about a 1950s nobody-turned-championship boxer forced to confront his own sexuality after a dethroned champion accuses him of being gay. So pop icon Madonna had originally bought the rights to the story, but Oliver Mayer went ahead and created this stage play. I think it just wrapped up in November, near the middle of November, up in LA. So we'll have to find out what's going on with it and where it's going next. And so glad to have Oliver on at about 9:15. He'll be calling in. So we're gonna talk about a few things this morning. Stacy is not here today. In that I'm flying solo. Oh, my God. So that's okay. I always like to do, I always like to do what this day in history, but I also like to try and focus on happy, good things that are happening in the LGBTQ community. And so it takes some searching, I have to say, because unfortunately, not all the news is good when it comes to LGBTQ. And so I did searching on many websites this last night and today, and I've come up with three positive things that I want to share as we go along. But first of all, let's go to this day in history. So today's the 8th, right? And, I don't want to forget to announce, what are you doing tomorrow, folks out there, because tomorrow there is a outrageously cool mosaic presentation by Mike Tauber, who's going to have a dedication at noon. And it's just not far away. It's on Glen Air. It's the mosaic mural dedicated to Laguna Beach. And it's called From the Festival of the Mosaics. It's from, I don't know how to describe it. Mike was on my program this last Thursday evening during Art Walk, because we now have a new program that I host, and it's called Art Walking Laguna Beach. So it's Art Walking Radio. So Mike was here along with Susan Brown and Leah Vasquez, and we talked about this mural mosaic that has popped up. And what it is, it's an aerial view of Laguna Beach. But you kind of have to know that when you look at it, because it's so intricate and there's so many facets to it. Excuse me. That once you realize it, you're like, there's an aha moment. So that dedication is tomorrow at noon. It's just a short dedication. Not to worry, it's going to be take your morning. But I think it would be great to go see it firsthand. It's being touted about on all sorts of media. And Mike Tauber is being given accolades for his brilliance in putting this together. So with many little small tiles put together to represent a big image, I think it's about 622 square feet, which is pretty huge. That's a lot of small tiles, and that's a lot of work. And there were a lot of volunteers behind it. So at least if you're driving down Glen Air and you're near Ralph's, look over. I guess it would be to the east. It's kind of hard to say which is northeast, south, and west in Laguna. But look over to your right if you're heading south or north, and it's right there in front of the Unity Church, Neighborhood Congregational Church, Laguna Beach. It's actual address is 340 St. Anne Drive. So, and that's right near, it's right on Glen Air. So please go see that. I think it would be a great Sunday afternoon to do, and maybe do a little shopping here in Laguna Beach and support the community. So I don't want to forget that. So on now my voice has kind of come back, so I'm feeling better. December 8th, this day in history, in 1981, the Gay Men's Chorus becomes the first openly gay musical group to play at Carnegie Hall. How about that? With their Christmas concert. So 81, that's quite a while ago. And that's certainly when the middle of the AIDS crisis too. So we're thankful that they made it. And I know we have our own Orange County Gay Men's Chorus, which does a lot of wonderful things. They're not alone in that. In 1987, the United Kingdom Conservative MP David Wilshire introduces Clause 28 as an amendment to the local government bill. The proposed amendment makes it illegal for local authorities to promote homosexuality or promote the teaching of any material school of the acceptability of homosexuality. So that's the negative news. I can't help it. So that's the on this day in history. I do have one for tomorrow, but I'm going to save it for after the next song. And we're going to take a short music break. We'll be back, and in just a few minutes, Oliver Mayer will be calling in. Okie dokie.
to run. Hands up, hands up. No complications, no second thought. Just hands up, hands up. I would walk away if they asked me to.
That song was called Back in the Day. Back in the Day, I love it. It talks about the ocean and personalities and wonderful things that you can garner from the ocean, I guess. Anyway, listen to the words. They're fabulous. Also, today in history, tomorrow, I got just a few items I want to share with you. But I also want to—I forgot a couple of announcements here. Today is KX93's Christmas party, and it's over at the Festival of the Arts grounds, and we have Heart there and a full program. Go to the website; it smacks you in the face on the homepage on KX93.com. That's KX93.com. And there's still tickets available, and it is our annual Christmas party gala. And it's supported by everyone, thousands and thousands of people. And it should be a blast on a brisk December evening, and with lots of warming of the heart and singing of some great classic songs by some classic entertainers that are still doing it and doing it right. So, on this day in history, in 1974, Minnesota State Senator Alan Speer becomes the first gay male office holder to come out of the closet publicly. Wow, 1974. In Minnesota, who would think? You'd think it'd be California. Oh, whatever. 1975, the Washington Star begins a series on homosexuality in American sports. Inspired, Washington Redskins linebacker David Cope, we all know David Cope, comes out on the series, author Lynn Rosalini. So there's some more history, but I think my guest is calling in. Hold on a second here. Oliver, are you there?
Yes, can you hear me?
I hear you. You're live on the radio as we speak.
It's great to hear from you. I'm glad I called in. Craig, how are you?
I'm fine. I got all the embarrassing stuff out of the way about you, but you have quite a story here, and while you're married in the conventional sense, you're very supportive of the diversity, as I can see, in your art and in what you endeavor.
I think I was brought up that way.
You know, that's a good answer. I love that answer. More people should be brought up that way, absolutely.
If my wife were on the phone right now, she'd probably talk to you a little bit about my mother. Because my mother really has love in her heart, loves all things, really, really does.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm a man who spent my life in the theater. You'd think I'd love the theater. I like the theater.
Okay.
My mother loves the theater. And she loves everything about it, you know. And I think in the end what she really loves is the community. And she loves the warmth of that, the family of that. And the open-heartedness of that, and she gave that to me. You know, I'm lucky she's still with me. She's, you know, she's 83 and a really youthful 83.
What's your mom's name?
So much to do with. Her name is Gloria.
Good morning, Gloria. If she listens,
yeah, gotta let her know about this because really, I haven't talked about her in an interview, and I should because she really. I grew up a bit of a hippie. Beatnik before that. I mean, she was a beatnik, and then she was a hippie, and then she had me, and she just instilled in me a curiosity in people.
You know, I want to touch on what you said a little bit there, Oliver, about getting acquainted with the theater and the culture there, because I had an personal experience myself, and I completely agree. I can't tell you how much I agree. I got kind of drawn into a theater troupe up in Boise, Idaho. Imagine that. And
it's beautiful there.
Yeah, it is beautiful. And I have met and still have so many dear friends through that experience. There's some kind of bond in that culture that is just so heartwarming that people want to get out there and share themselves so, I guess, clearly, so transparently. And that's difficult for a lot of people to do, but they get out and they get on the theater and the stage, and I don't know, it's a wonderful culture. I applaud you for that, and I applaud you for recognizing that that's a gift from your mother, right? Gloria.
It really is. And it's I tell you, I think the opportunity for anybody listening to get out of their own skin, to be able to play somebody else, to try to understand somebody else, maybe somebody quite different from who they are, what a gift in your life.
Yeah.
And what I think a lot of us get stuck on is that, and it's true, is that you don't make a lot of money in the theater. You make a lot of money on film and TV and other media. But what you get is something other than money.
Maybe that's why it's such a wonderful culture, because they're not there for accolades or money. They're there because they enjoy it.
there's something going on about faith. There's something going on about family, and there's something enriching that isn't monetary. And boy, you can't say that very often in life. I mean, I know you can't, but a lot of people really don't think like that, but they ought to.
Yeah, that's the rewards of living. So you, that was your first early introduction, and what kind of got you excited about, you know, I guess focusing on diversity? I don't know how else to characterize it in this.
Well, I think I'm a dramatist. So what happens is, you know, when you search for drama, when you're a playwright and you're looking for drama, you have to find it in people, and you have to find it in stories, and particularly in terms of LGBTQ stories. I grew up, you know, I was 17 in 1982, and in 1982, AIDS was named, and I became aware of it really kind of just, it wasn't direct in my face, it was something around, it was something that I'd heard about because of, I don't know, almost like it was a secret that was being let out, and it was something that was scary. And
definitely.
I realized that that friends of mine and potentially I myself could be in danger, and I didn't know what it was. So that particular story galvanized. I mean, to this day, a play I just closed is about this subject. But I remember at 17 not having enough information, but realizing that a circle of friends and I might be in the line of fire. So the dramatist in me said, oh, my God, this is a story. But I've been looking for such stories. Like I say, you know, I've written over 30 plays, and none of them can kind of get to the end unless they have some kind of story that at least grips me. Because if I get gripped, then I could grip you or someone else with the passion with which I tell that story.
Yeah.
So I think to be an like I would call myself an ally, to be an ally, and particularly with LGBTQ stories, is simply to try to tell them well and truthfully and to be curious about kind of what's at stake.
Yeah.
And that's the biggest issue of all. I think in my lifetime, people of color and people with other diverse behavior and identity identifiers have had about as much at stake as anything in the last 50 years. So they deserve to have their stories told on stage.
Well, I'm going to touch back on your comments about the hysteria and not understanding what HIV was. Just this last week in India, they found a woman who had died in a lake, a fairly large lake, and she was HIV. And the community insisted that they drain the lake because felt that the water would be hazardous. And that hysteria is still going on today, and we forget that sometimes. And so with that, there's certainly a message and a story to be told, and as part of what you're doing, for certain. So, but back to what you were saying just recently, you're passionate, and so it's that passion to tell the story is that correct?
I believe so.
Yeah,
I believe so, and it has a lot to do again with. You have to fall in love, and that's one of the best parts of doing what I do. All the best stories are love stories. We know that.
Yeah,
and in a lot of ways, the unlikeliest love stories make the best love stories, and the ones in some ways that you know don't seem to be. I don't know. Even if they're the ones we've seen before, that they have something about them that that is unexpected, and so there's a discovery that's possible. So I've always, you know, I mean, I always try to, I got to tether it to myself, to who I am, but then I want to get far afield. I want to try to experience in the stories that I write, you know, people's lives who do a lot of things that I've never done. You know, and have a lot of knowledge and have a lot of experience that are incredibly human, but also, you know, things that I could only dream about. So I think that that's the dramatist's life, is to try to build a population of characters that kind of still has my DNA, but has done lots of lots of amazing things and lots of different things and gone through really, really important experiences.
So,
I mean, I think in the end, the biggest and most important thing, and particularly for people listening now, is that we got through it. I mean, as you say, it's not over.
Yeah.
We know it's not over, and that AIDS and HIV is still an issue, and also misinformation in this country is still an issue, but also that we got through a scourge that probably a lot of people thought would be, you know, not just the death of us, but the death of the death of an entire generation and politics and everything. And we got through it.
Yeah, there's still World AIDS Day was December 1st, and we had a ceremony here. And I went to look at some of the statistics. Still, there it's estimated between 32 million and 46 million people have died of HIV and AIDS. And presently, they believe, as best as they can count, this is the World Health Organization, that there's 36 million infected globally as we speak. So that's a lot of it's a lot of work to keep it, to manage it, and make it the world better. And I don't know. I guess that's just kind of as a side note, but certainly. So you mentioned that some of the HIV issue and stuff, and probably I guess some of the homophobia. I haven't seen your play, but Members mm-hmm. Only.
Yes.
How did you come about that? I also mentioned that Madonna had the original. So are you chumming up with Madonna and got the?
I did at one point. It's been a while. I haven't seen her in a long time.
Yeah.
But. So some years ago, quite a few years ago, I was a young writer, and I wrote a play called Blade to the Heat. And that play did capture the interest of Madonna for some years.
Oh, wow.
And it was going to be a movie many times and ended up not happening.
What's the synopsis of that Blade to the Heat? It sounds interesting.
Blade to the Heat is set in the late 50s, and it's about a young half-Mexican, half-Anglo, kid from L.A. who's a boxer and goes to New York and wins a world title, defeats a great champion, after which he just seems to act a little differently from everyone else. He's not interested in going to the same parties. And somebody starts a rumor about his sexuality, that he's gay. And this is 1959. I don't have to tell you, 1959, Liberace was straight.
Yeah,
right?
Oh, yeah.
So, I mean, there was no gay in 1959. If you were or not, there was still no identity. And so to be called this and in this world of boxing is, you know, could be a death sentence. It's a really, really bad thing. And the thing about it is that the young man, his name is Pedro Quinn. Quinn is, he is gay. He doesn't know yet. He's really very, very young, and he hasn't had a lot of experience. So the play follows him and leads to a rematch with the man he defeated, who wants to kill him now. He's a Latin man. Mm-hmm. And he's actually, this has unleashed a whole side of himself. He's getting dreams about men. He's unable to sleep with his girlfriend. He's having all kinds of problems, and he needs to kill this guy.
Well, so yeah, it's a threat against its masculinity.
You nailed it. So when they fight for everything but the sport. They're, you know, it just becomes like a dog fight. And the young fighter actually is quite willing to be defeated. He feels, you know, less than and all that stuff you might expect.
Yeah.
But at the very last second, the champion disrespects him. He's unable to knock him down, but he kisses him in the ring, and then he knocks him down. And when Quinn rises, he's furious, and he punches back, and he kills his opponent. Oh. And that is, you know, and that's something you never get over. So that's the way that puts the tragedy.
Is it some of this based on some actual?
Yes. There was a fighter named Emil Griffith in the early 60s who had a very similar experience. And he went and fought on for many, many years, but, you know, was never really able to get away from the tragedy of this. So indeed, after Blade to the Heat, 20 some years late, maybe 21 years after the last big sort of production of Blade to the Heat, I created Members Only. Members Only takes Quinn 20 years into the future.
Okay.
So that play ended around 1960, 61. So this takes him up to 1982. And so this young man who is trying to fight his sexuality, who is involved in a tragedy in the first play, is now a man in his 40s who continues to fight well beyond his prime, and who has been able to forge a life, what we would call a gay life, in New York, in a period when that was possible, but is not out. And this man feels as if, you know, he has a life. But in members only, everything gets scrambled up again. The biggest thing happening is indeed that there is a as yet unnamed, about to be named illness that is on the scene. But that also that the world is changing. And in members only, the biggest thing that happens is a young female fighter is in the gym. And these are the days before women were in male gyms. Very seldom. I mean, they were, but very seldom. And they were also very much, they would get bullied at the least, and worse than that. So this young woman gets his curiosity going. And, of course, he sees himself the way that he was shunned 20 years earlier. So he supports her. And what happens in members only is that Quinn gets one more chance to win a title, and is he's blinded. And so that's the end of his career, of course. But in a lot of ways, it's the end of potentially it really throws everything up because he'd been the protector of this young woman. Now he's afraid that terrible things will happen to her. And he has to find a way. He has to find a way over
Pedro
the course
Quinn.
Of play. Yeah, Pedro Quinn has to find a way to still be functional, to still be, a difference maker. That's the biggest thing I think these stories tell me is that, you know, I know you know this, that you have to find a way to be a difference maker, even when the chips are down, especially when the chips are down.
I mean, what you just told me is that it's a trifecta. His first challenge was just the boxing and doing the best he could. And the second challenge was the prejudice and coming out. And the third one is living in 82 when, I mean, it's the whole life he's been challenged and had tragedy, right? I suppose.
Yes.
You see it through generations. What happens in his life as an example to what's probably happened to a lot of people's lives. But
yes.
Wow. So you worked. I see it says Jose Luis Valenzuela directs this stage production. And
yes.
Was it pretty well received in L.A. up there?
Extremely well received, to the point that at the moment we're really actively looking to continue it, probably in another city. You know, whether that's New York, Chicago, Bay Area, San Francisco, or wherever we can.
Well, Laguna Beach's little theater
Laguna
here.
would be amazing. I love the theater in Laguna Beach.
It is amazing what happens at this little theater. We get so many people, so many productions that are up there in L.A., and they have a day or two or three or four days, and they swing down to the little playhouse here, and I'm in it. I shouldn't say it's little. It's nice. It's a nice size. It's intimate enough and yet not so big that you get lost in the crowd. So,
wow. You know, you're giving me a real thought here because I love that theater, and I've seen some good shows. I remember seeing, the one about the dance lessons. We saw that fairly recently. That was great. And it's a beautiful space, and we really do want to try to revisit the play. I think, you know, that's what happens when you do a play, when you have a production together, is that you learn what it is. It usually takes the entire set of performances for you to figure out what the heck you were doing.
I understand what you're saying.
Absolutely.
Well, you know, we did have, was it The End of the Rainbow, which was quite a production of the story of Judy Garland, which is very tragic, but that production down here sold out and had been in L.A. prior to that. I don't know if they're still going on. They were touring with it as well, but they've had a lot of... And the theater here has been so, so supportive of this program and a huge part of the community.
I hope they're listening today because I think I'm going to call them on Monday morning.
I would be happy to campaign on your behalf with them as well, too.
You, Craig? Because I tell you, I think that, well, I don't have to tell you either. You know from having lived in this part of Southern California, but there's a real change in the works, isn't there? I mean, it's still the same people and everything, but, you know, look at this new voices we saw in the elections. There's new stories that need to be told. And that's the thing about kind of, I guess, you know, history, his story, right? But
yeah.
The idea that, you know, we think of a place and we hear the stories about a place. And then suddenly we find out, wow, well, that was only one of the stories. There's so many more things going on, aren't there?
There
so
are.
In a lot of ways, this is and this is a fundamentally Southern California story. So I have a feeling that the Laguna Beach audience would really enjoy the music and the physicality. But I think they'd also understand that this is a homegrown story.
Yeah, no, that would be great. I love the multicultural aspect of it, too. Not just the LGBTQ spin on it, but the culture.
Well, I don't have to tell you the two that 1982, I don't know what it makes you think about, but I think about the music. Think about the crazy styles, crazy hairdos, but I do think about the music. It was, you know, disco was on the wane.
Oh, my God. Studio,
still there.
Studio 54 was
Studio 54, yeah. And we even have in the play a rival disco, Xenon. I don't know if you remember Xenon.
But I don't remember
Midtown,
that one. But
Midtown New York disco that was one of those really great sweaty places with all of that fabulous music. But then you had that whole downtown scene. You had, you know, that Talking Heads, the kind of Laurie Anderson kind of scene, which is in there. And then I even add, because it has Latin themes, is the amazing salsa of the time.
Oh,
Willie Colon.
Great.
All that. I mean, the best dance.
So if nothing else, you should come for the music.
That is true. So on top, it's a little bit like a hero sandwich. That's the way I think about plays. You just keep layering on.
I just got to say real quickly,
go ahead.
Keep us legal. This is Craig Cooley on Rainbow Radio, KX93.5, Laguna Beach's only FM radio. And we're interviewing Oliver Mayer, if you just tuned in. And this a stage play that he has created along with director Jose Luis Valenzuela, called Members Only, and we're trying to drag it down here to Laguna Beach because it sounds so sensational.
Oh, boy, this is a really good interview.
Well, I told everyone, I did my e-blast, I said, it's all about Oliver today.
who happened
to be my father's name, actually. So,
oh,
yeah.
It's one of those names I read in the paper that it's now one of the most popular names for babies.
So, really?
Yeah, and I wish him well. I mean, it's a hard one usually when you're in elementary school, but it just gets better and better after that.
Yeah, very cool. Very cool. So with this under your belt, I wouldn't say it's under your belt because it's still ongoing. What are you looking to the future, Oliver, with any productions? Do you have any new stories to be told?
I do. I'm writing a musical. I've got the book and lyrics.
Imagine that, a straight guy doing a musical. I don't get it.
I know.
That's the gay genre. Are you sure? Where are you on the Kinsey report?
Oh, well. Very confused, as you can see. Yes. It's,
we'll give you an honorary gay card.
Oh, God.
Honorary.
That sounds good. That sounds great. Yeah, my musical is underway, and it's a kind of a wild experience. If you can believe it, it's funded by the Polish government.
Poland.
What? It's wild.
Archie Bunker would be really angry about that.
Yes, we don't use that particular word, the way that derivation of Polish people. But yes, there was a great Pole, and his name was Paderewski. I don't know if you've ever heard of him, but he was one of the greatest pianists of his day. He was a composer.
Yes.
But the thing that's amazing about him, that was just one of his amazing lives. He lived at least three lives in one, because he also was a statesman. He was the founder of the current Polish nation.
Oh, wow.
And he was a winemaker.
Oh, I like that combination.
Me too. And he lived in Paso Robles, and he was one of the first people to make Zinfandel, which, of course, is like, you know, one of the fundamental California wines.
Absolutely.
So what a life he lived. He happened to be rather devastatingly handsome in his youth. I think that helped him a lot as a performer. He also kind of invented the idea of the touring pianist or the touring performer. Before him, people would come from Europe and they'd go to New York, Chicago, San Francisco, and they'd done the United States. He would go to Stockton. He'd go to Laguna Beach. He would go, and if you had a good piano, he would play it.
Uh-huh.
And so he toured everywhere, and so everyone got to know him. So probably our grandparents or great-grandparents would have been very familiar with Paderewski from just hearing how great he was. Wow. And what a cool person he was. So I wrote a musical called Three Paderewskis. And the joke there is, like I just said, is he lived so much for more than any one person could. So I said, once I read about his life, I'm like, wow, I need three guys. They need three Paderewskis. So
that's a triple header.
I had the title. And one of my Paderewskis is a woman. And that's not necessarily like a pants roll opera thing, although there is a history of that. It's just simply that I think he had, you know, he had a female self. He had I think, you know, in our own way of looking at man, woman, and whatever that all means, I think he had a very well-developed feminine side, and it came out in his music. It came out in his efforts. Anyway, it's turned into a really beautiful piece of a beautiful musical because I've got this great composer named Jenny Brandon, and she's from Long Beach, and she's done lots and lots of beautiful music, a lot of sacred music, but I got her involved in dramatic stuff, and we've done a little bit before, and now we've done this musical, and we're not done yet. We're into our second act, but we just presented. About a week ago, we've presented actually twice in the last month with some really top flight singers. And so people are pretty excited, including the Poles. So yeah. I would say we've got about a year and a half to develop the second half of this piece. And then hopefully around 2020, you'll hear about Three Paderewskis.
What the message is in this new production, Three Paderewskis. Am I saying that right?
Yeah. Yes, you are.
Three Paderewskis. Is there a underlying message? Is it just that how remarkable one person can be is the message?
Certainly there's a celebration of the man, but I do think that you only want to sort of write about the past in order to understand it for the present and maybe for the future. It's the only, I think, you know, reason to do this kind of work beyond just enjoying it. So what are we trying to learn from this guy's experience, I think, is that it takes an incredible amount of effort to change the world, and that he did it, but he did it at a great expense. And that for one thing, another thing is I think tragedy can also sometimes send a person, you know, some people maybe never get over it, but they also give to the world in incredible ways.
Yeah.
He lost his wife in childbirth at age 20, and I think that would have broken a lot of people, and maybe in some ways it broke him. But what did he do? He put the feeling into the music. He had a very active romantic life, and he eventually married again and married well. So it's not as if he stopped.
Right.
I think he admitted the pain and the loss, but he was able to channel that into something that other people could feel and value.
And move forward. Yeah.
I mean, I think that's something that every single one of us needs to hear. So and the other thing is, you know, he had a fundamental need to liberate his own people, and he was willing to take years of his life to help that happen. And even when it kind of didn't go all the way that he wanted it to, it didn't make him a negative person. So I just can't help but think in our own times, the way that I am one of them, the way we get so life and death about politics or what the current president's doing or what's happening in an election, that we have to remember that we can feel it that deeply and we're not wrong to do so, but we also have to move on.
Move forward. Yeah, absolutely. That's really a good message. I like that. So then it takes about a year and a half to put a stage play together like this.
Yeah, it's taken about a year and a half to get this far. We've got an act.
Okay.
And you know, I'll tell you, I mean, in some ways it's such a beautiful act. Maybe it has a kind of a standalone quality, but there's just more I want to do.
Yeah.
So I think that we're going to keep going, and we're going to, you know, I don't know if it'll be, maybe it'll all end up being a kind of a long one act. That happens a lot these days in plays and in musicals that people don't take breaks anymore. So, you know, the cocktail, the bar at the theater, you know, they're not making much money anymore. Yeah. So I don't know if we'll end up doing it like that or if we will keep a break and move forward. But I just know that the man's life was so full that there's more to say.
Well, and I think what I sense a message there, it's something to compare, like you said, compare his culture of persevering and taking, living through adversity and coming out on the other side, you know, better for whatever it is. Maybe not perfect, but better. And I think that that's something to apply to all of us today in today's culture.
I agree with you.
You know, come forward better than what has happened. You know, I've seen in my lifetime, I've seen people that have been stymied by a bad event and fail to ever go any further, and they have a sad life. I've also seen the other side of that, they seize the opportunity, and I think with some renewed energy, they feel responsible to charge forward and take care of themselves and the world in the process, hopefully.
Well, you know, and hopefully they deserve to have their stories told. And that's the thing that happens in the theater is, I mean, it may be called Three Paderewskis, but I do think people in the audience, they identify. I mean, here's a Pole and someone who lived a long time ago and played, maybe a lot of us play the piano, but still, you know, played at this level and had these extraordinary experiences. And yet there's something transferable, there's something relatable, there's something fundamentally, you know,
relevant
and relevant that we all see. And as long ago as that was, he was dealing with a lot of stuff that we're dealing with now. He was just trying to, I think, to make sure that he and his and the people he loved had some basic freedoms, and he would be satisfied to have achieved that. And the good news is, you know, 100 years later, Poland is a functioning nation. It's got a lot of problems.
Yeah.
Still does, never hasn't. But
who doesn't?
He was able to create something. The other
he made a difference.
Oh boy.
Yeah.
And Poles, the thing I've learned, I've been there recently, is Poles really love the United States.
Even today? I shouldn't say that.
Well, you and I, yes. Despite recent choices.
Yeah.
I think that the Poles have a love of, they even had sent a man here when we were fighting our Revolutionary War. Kosciuszko was someone who fought alongside Lafayette and Washington. And he went back to Europe and talked about how wonderful this place was. And I think the French and the Poles really believed him. So that the Poles have this view of the United States that it goes back generations. And of course, you know, all of the Polish people who emigrated over the years, you know, but there's a real strong tie between these nations as far away as we are. I mean, Poland is almost in Russia, right?
Yeah.
And yet we, you know, and yet there's this feeling like, oh, our brothers are American brothers, which is kind of great.
So, Oliver, there's quite a lot of your work that is preceded both Members Only and the three Paderewskis.
Yes.
And I don't want to dismiss that. Have you done stage acting yourself then? Is that how you first came into this?
It probably is how I came into it, but I did my acting resume is about, you know, a fingernail. I did a few. I'll tell you what happened. I'll go back to my mother.
You can talk about your mother all you want. I'm good with that.
Oh, good. Because as a teen, well, she's really worth it. As a teenager, I was probably like a lot of listeners. I was really awkward. I had pimples. I was really angry, belligerent, and didn't have a lot of friends. And my father kind of threw up his hands. What he told me to do is go. I was boxing, and so he liked that. So that's how I know this boxing thing. I was a boxer, and that appealed to my father's sense of things. But my mother told me the way that I could do better would be to take an acting class. And I did, and I hated it, and I was lousy at it. all the way up until maybe, I think it was our final presentation, and something happened. I did Our House, Our Town. Welders Our Town. I did that famous scene at the having whatever phosphates or milkshakes or whatever we had in that scene, George and Emily, and something clicked, and I ended up doing well. And so I had a couple of years there where I was, I don't know, a little bit in that game. And what I realized is that I didn't have the staying power, but I really, really enjoyed the people. So by that time, I was able to go to England. I went to Oxford, and I was studying. And what you do there is there's a lot of opportunity to do amateur theater there. So I did some plays, and again, I don't think I'm a very good actor, but I made a lot of friends. And over a few beers, I said, "Hey, I think I'm going to write you guys a play." And the first play I wrote was weak. The second play I wrote was strong enough that it got done professionally in Oxford, and we took it to the Edinburgh Fringe. And I was reviewed by the Scotsman, and I had a professional, I was a professional experience, and I wasn't even 20 years old yet. So I came back to the United States, a produced playwright, and I just liked the sound of that, and I'm 53 now, so we're talking 33 years of doing this, and I've done a few things as well, but I've never stopped writing plays from the age of 19.
Wow. So I'll have to give you my play story sometime. Everyone has one, right?
Please.
So was it Ellen at one of the awards ceremonies tried to get Martin Scorsese to read a stage play she'd written?
That's great.
It was tongue in cheek, but it was great because that's what everyone has a story and they all want to have them told.
And they deserve to.
Yeah.
I never poo-poo it, I'll tell you. And of course it can be a pain when someone slips you. Like, it happens to me a lot in my work that people, you know, want me to see what they're doing or a story of their father. Or, boy, I have just the story for you. But I know enough not to throw cold water on that kind of stuff because, you know what? Some of those stories have to get told.
Well, I'm going to tell you, Talking to the Cows is the name of this one. And it's about a little farm boy, has a horrible experience at school. There's all sorts of bad things that happen in his life. And the only person he can talk to is the pasture behind the house and the cows. And he'd run home, get out of the school bus. You can see the dust flying from the school bus. He runs in the house, throws his books down, grabs some carrots, and runs out to the back because he's had a really bad day and he wants to talk to the cows. And those big brown eyes, you know, that kind of open and close, and they just chew and they just listen. And so the story goes that he's all these experiences as a child. He goes into adulthood. Now he's, you know, 55. How old are you?
I'm 53.
Okay, 53. And he's successful. He's got the BMW and he's got all these crises in his life. And he's driving along in a rural area and there's a cow by the fence. And he slams the brakes on. And I'm going to cry. And he goes out and he talks to the cows again. And realizes that, like the child, he's going to get through what he's going through now.
Incredible.
And, and that's the message. Because I don't know. But the brilliant part about it, I think, is that you can have these little vignettes of these experiences through his life that build on his character and take him to where he is. And he almost comes full circle. Well, he does come full circle and realizes that it's okay. You know, whatever it is, it's okay. So.
Yeah.
So I'll.
Oh, how wonderful.
We'll talk about it. I shouldn't be promoting myself so much, but you sound like the type of person who would understand it and appreciate what I'm saying here. But so what really razzed your berries early on was writing, obviously, and getting people to portray the characters that you held close to yourself and felt a lot about. Correct.
I think that's correct. That very first play, you know, I was in England and I was an American. It was 1984. Reagan was just reelected. A lot of us were very ashamed and upset about it. And boy, the English did not treat Americans very well that year. That's from memory. And so I felt on the outside, but I was, you know, in a wonderful place for the first time, living for a full year in England. And I I was fascinated by the roots of the culture. And I had an opportunity to travel over the Christmas holidays. I walked a Roman road. It was an over 2,200-year-old road that the Romans had constructed. And it was, you know, dirt, but I mean, it was, you know, beautifully beautiful.
Should be humbling.
And it had a quality to it. I guess I think I had a fever at the time and it was raining, but there was a feeling I felt like I was a centurion or something. It took me back thousands of years to be on that road. And it made me think about what it might have been like at that time. And it made me think about the people, the English people who were there, who were of a Celtic nature, you know, who had a belief system that was probably quite foreign to what we think, you know, in a very sort of Christian, you know, Anglo-English belief systems that we might think of now. And that made me go. And I just started writing, and I ended up with this really kind of exotic and interesting piece called Gog. It's my very first play. But I think it is instructive of the way that I look at plays, which is, you know, I need to get fascinated, but I also want to do a kind of a lot of research, and some of it is book research, but a lot of it is just kind of imagining what it might be like to be there at the time.
Like, and the Romans going down the...
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And what a vivid
image. Were there when the Romans came.
What a vivid image you've painted here. That's
well,
great.
Well, it is kind of, I think it is the trick, and anybody who's writing, who's listening, I think they understand too, that the vividness is all. That what's really, really important is to thrust, to bring your audience to a place where they're experiencing it too. Where they're in the middle of it, where we don't have to explain anything. What's more important is to put them in the situation.
Yes.
Because we're human beings. We may have a series of reactions and they may not all be the same, but they're pretty close.
You know, it speaks to any kind of art you do. The artist needs to send this message however they can, and so does the stage play, and so do the actors and everything else. If you can't touch on that person in some way that is personal, then you haven't achieved your real success, I don't think. But that's just me. What do I know?
Well, we agree.
We agree. We're unanimous in that.
Yeah, we're unanimous. We might have our dust caps on, but we agree.
I just got about enough time to wrap up here. Did you? I could go on for hours, but unfortunately, my show's only an hour long. I'll talk to him about extending it tomorrow. But is there anything you want to add? Any tidbits or anything you want to share with us, Oliver?
Well, I just believe in a life in art, and I do think it's possible to still, you know, survive. I mean, we all have to do it, whatever our day gig is, and I think that's great. But I just hope that shows like yours are reminding people that they do have, you know, they have this in their hearts, and they have this in their experience. And I do think we have the energy, if we want to put it there. It's sometimes as little as just a few minutes a day to be taking notes, to be, you know, using language, to be remembering maybe visually if it's through photographs or what have you, you know, the world as it is around us, which is so extraordinary. And these are the moments, you know. It's funny, my wife was just looking at some photographs from some years ago, and it brought us back, really brought us back to who we were then. And who we were then is a little different than who we are now.
Yeah, that is shocking sometimes.
Isn't it amazing? Yeah, I mean, you know, we're still recognizable, of course.
Right.
But we were in a different place. We've been through something, and it's not all good. But there's something about threading that loop, you know, threading the needle through that, you know, almost like you're putting your button back on your coat. But in the experience of going around, you learn something. In the experience of kind of looping the loop and tying that knot, you maybe understand yourself more in the times you've lived in ways that you wouldn't have otherwise, and you can help somebody when you
do it. That is great. No, that's the message should feed the soul, a good message that brings the spirit and helps the human psyche be the best we can be. Because sometimes the human psyche is very delicate, I found.
Yes.
Yeah.
Beautifully said.
Yeah. So I want to thank you so much for getting up early this morning. I know playwrights sleep, work till 2 or 3 in the morning, and that's when their best work is created, maybe after a bottle of wine, right?
Did you have a camera on last night? Because that's kind of what happened.
Well, you know, Oliver, bless you for being in the world. Bless you for being on the show and sharing your love for your art and your love of the path that you've gone. And bless your mother, for Christ's sakes.
I'm going to make sure that she listens to this.
Okay.
Her ears are burning. Someone's going to give her a phone call and say, did you hear what was on the radio?
And we'll work on getting you here to the Laguna Theater.
Let's do that, too. Yeah. I'm pretty excited about bringing the play to your audience. That sounds great.
And you have a Merry Christmas and Happy New Year, and enjoy all the holidays, whatever they mean to you.
Thank you, Craig, and happy holiday to everybody.
Thank you. Thank you. This is KX93.5, Laguna Beach's only FM radio. This is Craig here saying adios to Oliver. And we're on here now with Ida May and her program. And we're just going to do a quick switch here. I'm just pass the microphone over.
Okay, good morning to you and all of you out there. This is Ida May. I'm back in the saddle again.